Hi, I'm Jerry Ellis, and welcome to Talking Apes. If you and I were living in the bushlands of what is now East Africa, say 2.5 million years ago or so, this... might be the key sound in the soundtrack of our lives. That's the sound of stone tools being crafted, something my next guest knows a lot about. In this episode of Talking Apes, we are entering a sort of podcast time machine for a journey into our collective past. Our guide is Dr. Brianna Pobener. Brianna is a paleoanthropologist whose research centers on the evolution of the human diet, with a focus on meat eating, trying to understand the transition between our ancient relatives being scavengers and hunters. We'll also explore how modern chimpanzees' carnivory might help us understand what our fossil record can't reveal. Brianna has done fossil sleuthing fieldwork in Kenya, Tanzania, South Africa, and Indonesia. In 2005, she joined the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. to help put together the Hall of Human Origins. Brianna now leads the Human Origins Program's education and outreach effort. That's all to say Brianna loves talking about her work and the origins of apes like us. So much so that she is the recipient of the 2021 American Association of Biological Anthropologists and Leakey Foundation Communication and Outreach Award, as well as the 2021 National Center for Science Education Friend of Darwin Award. Brianna is also an associate research professor of anthropology in the Center for the Advanced Study of Human Paleobiology at George Washington University. Thanks again for joining me on this episode of Talking Apes. You're listening to the podcast that gets to the heart of what's happening with and to apes like us. Talking Apes is made possible through the generous support of listeners like you and through our growing Patreon members program. For as little as $3 a month, we invite you to join those who have already committed to making this podcast a success. To support Talking Apes, start by visiting our website at talkingapes.org. That's talkingapes, one word, .org. And there you can choose between donate and become a monthly Patreon member. And now, I'm delighted to welcome bone historian Dr. Brianna Pobener. Hi, Brianna. Welcome to Talking Apes. I love this subject, so I am super excited to have you on and talking. It's not something we usually talk about just chimps or gorillas, but actually to talk about early us. That's kind of cool.
Well, thank you.
So welcome to Talking Apes.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You know, to get us started, I wanted to ask you a question that I know you've answered more than once, but the reason I want to ask it is because you say that when I've heard you answer it in other presentations, you always said, every time you get asked that question, you have a different answer. So I'm going to ask it because I want to see what different answer you have this time. What does it mean to be human?
Yes. So it's a question that is sort of the theme question of the Smithsonian's Human Origins Program and our Hall of Human Origins at the Natural History Museum in DC. If you want to answer that question yourself, you can go to the homepage of our website. But yeah, so every time I get asked this question, it's just depending on what's going on with me that day that I have a different answer. I think today I'm feeling like it has a lot to do with kind of community and connections. And not that that makes us, you know, having community and connections doesn't make us unique, but I don't know, the complexity of our communities that we live in and the, you know, deep bonds that we have is, I don't know, that's how I'm feeling today.
No, I think that's an interesting answer because culture is now becoming a bigger and bigger subject. When we talk to primatologists about other types of, you know, groups of apes, whether it's, you know, chimpanzees or gorillas and stuff, we start, that word culture keeps coming into it and community is part of that. And it's, I think it's something that we always assume with humans, but I don't know that we really, I don't know how much we really think about what that word means to us as humans. It's a pretty complex word. Community.
Yeah. And I think it probably means different things to different people at different times and different places, all of that.
Let's start. I guess, talk to me like I'm a fourth grader and explain to me what human evolution is.
So human evolution is really the process by which people became who they are today. It has to do with our deep, deep ancestry and how our ancient, great, great, great grandparents changed over time and became us today. And understanding that process and all the different sort of things that went into it, that's what it is to study human evolution, to figure out how we got to who we are today.
So the great confusion, I think, for most people is that, you know, there's this kind of stereotypic myth that floats around out there that we all evolved from chimpanzees. And after being around a lot of chimpanzees and bonobos over time, they don't like that at all. they say, don't stereotype us with you human types. No, but seriously, break that down a little bit and talk about who we have been over the last, 16 million years plus.
Yeah. So I think that's probably the most common misconception when it comes to human evolution. And, one way to ask that question is sort of if we evolved from chimps, which we didn't, and I'll get to that, why are there still chimps today? And so sometimes I like to think of it like a family tree. And so chimps, bonobos, gorillas, orangutans, great apes, and, primates writ large are our cousins. So we're all around today. If you were to draw your family tree, you would have your parents and you would have your grandparents and you would have your great grandparents. And the further back you go, in a sense, those are your common ancestors with your cousins. So the species that are around today, the other apes, are our cousins, but they're not the ancestors that we evolved from. So those common ancestors would have had some characteristics similar to us, some characteristics similar to those other apes, but we didn't evolve from anything alive today. Chimps, bonobos, other apes have been evolving for just as long as we have, just on a different branch of our family tree.
So the question would always come up, like, okay, then if we have this common ancestor, what is it that we share with them and how is it we're different now? Because you hear things like we're 98% the same DNA as chimpanzees. Well, that would seem like that's a lot. However, as Richard Wrangham at Harvard, who we had on the podcast once, he said, we share 50% of our DNA with bananas too.
Exactly. And there's that's one of the most fun facts that people take home from our Hall of Human Origins, because we have that there also. So yeah, what does that mean? It is 98% is a very, big percent of our DNA that we share with chimpanzees, but obviously that 2% that we don't is really important. So we share, the basic substrate of how life works, physiology, anatomy. Our anatomy is very similar, but also some differences. So modern humans, we walk upright on two legs. We're bipedal, as it's called. Sure, chimps and bonobos can walk upright on two legs, but it's not what they do usually. Usually they walk on four legs. We don't have thick fur hair covering our entire bodies. That's one of the differences. But we do have these, fine hair coverings. We have binocular vision. We have like five digits on our fingers and toes. And the cool thing about human bodies, in a way, is that we are this archive of evolution, and we share a lot of that evolutionary history with our closest living relatives. One of the other interesting differences, so at the common ancestor that we shared with chimps and bonobos, once our family tree branched off from that common ancestor, two things we see right at the base or the root or the trunk, I guess, of that tree. One is walking upright on two legs. So everything that is more closely related to humans than other living apes, those are hominins, those extinct species that are on our side of the tree. And the two characteristics that we see in all hominins, one is bipedal upright walking. The other is having small canine teeth. So what's that about? So if you think about, if you've seen photos of chimpanzees with their mouths wide open, you see these big canines that are mostly used for threatening, for social interactions, not actually for chewing food, but really for social interactions. And so at the very root of the hominin family tree, canines are smaller on those earliest species. And because large canines are usually used for threat displays, for dominance, we think that having small canines signals something socially. Without a time machine, we can't go back and actually observe the social interactions of those earliest members of our family tree. But it's possible that there was less competition among males. Maybe there was a little bit more, friendly social interactions, and that there were other ways of establishing dominance that didn't have to do with baring your teeth and doing it that way.
Going back to that word community in the beginning, I mean, that sounds like a cooperation thing potentially came out of that. You know, if you're going to work in this community, and especially if you were a smaller primate, a smaller ape, cooperation would be a really critical thing at that point.
Exactly. And I think, you know, there are folks that study more sort of later human behavior that really emphasize how unusually cooperative we are as modern humans. Yes, we engage in warfare and, you know, can do terrible things to each other, but the scale of human cooperation is really unparalleled.
Yeah, it really is. My brain's spinning here with questions. So that's why I was so excited to have you on. So where does your work begin in that chain of our ancient history?
Yeah. And so in the chain, and actually instead of a chain, I always like to think of it as a bush. So, so thinking about sort of that family tree, the branch that I'm really interested in is the one that our genus is represented by, earliest members of the genus Homo. So we are Homo sapiens. The earliest fossils that we see members of our genus go back to almost 3 million years at this point. And I'm particularly interested in maybe the 2 million years, 1.5 million years ago, in that kind of time range. And my research focuses on the evolution of human diets and particularly meat eating in human prehistory. We see the earliest evidence for that right around that time. It looks like there is an increase through our evolutionary history in meat eating. We're certainly omnivores today, and I think probably really all hominins were. But I'm interested in how adding meat from big animals into our diets really shifted a lot of our behavior, biology, ecology, and kind of our adaptations.
How did that manifest itself? What does it look like to say, oh, there's this point where we started eating meat? Like, what are the signals that were sent out, whether it's in the fossil record or wherever? Yeah.
The cool thing about diets particularly, but meat eating, is that there's lots of different ways to study it. You can look at the chemistry of fossil bones to look at the types of foods that different hominins or early humans were eating. The way that I do it is that I look at fossils of animals from archaeological sites that have butchery marks made by early stone tools that humans used to butcher those animals. So those, in a way, those butchery marks are the smoking guns to let me know that early humans were involved in these animal fossils being here in some way. And when you start to look at the pattern of where the butchery marks are on the bones, what kinds of animals are they on? Where do those animals live? Are they getting the sort of meaty, juicy parts of the animals, or are they only getting scraps? When I start to look at those patterns, then I can really ask and sometimes answer questions about how important meat eating was in our evolutionary history, how we might have been competing with carnivores, other predators, to be able to get that meat, and what that might have meant for our other aspects of human evolution, of the technological record, of our habitat preferences, and where early humans, prefer to hang out in the landscape, who else they might have been interacting with.
So those butchery marks, and we'll talk about them a little bit more in a minute. I'm thinking of my experience with chimps and hunting colobus mm-hmm. monkeys. They're eating meat, but they're not leaving. Well, not that I noticed at the time. Now I'm feeling guilty that I didn't take a closer examination of those bones in the aftermath of that hunting and sharing of meat. But they weren't using tools in this case. This was at Gombe Stream in Tanzania. And they went up, they killed the colobus, brought it down, and then sort of, you know, separated it all out and were eating this meat. So if those marks, those butchery marks are that indication, like there would have been a period before that, that they would have just, especially a scavenger, that they may not have left any mark behind.
Well, interestingly, I think early human scavengers probably did leave those marks behind if they were accessing and butchering animals that were big enough that they needed tools to be able to either get into the skin. So again, smaller canines, less sharp teeth, not really being able to actually get into the skin of bigger animals. And also, if you're cutting up parts of animals and taking it away, if you're, hey, I don't want to get eaten by that saber-toothed cat who's also sniffing around this carcass, then you're going to, you know, pull part of the carcass away and go eat it in safety. But the good news is, actually, there are folks that watched chimpanzees hunt colobus monkeys and then collected the bones. So one of my earlier publications was actually studying a collection of colobus monkey bones that were chewed on by chimpanzees. So yes, there are actually marks potentially from that sort of earlier time period if we want to think about chimps hunting colobus as one kind of model of pre-technological carnivory, you know, meat eating by stone tool wielding early humans. And you can see tooth marks on those bones. And the other thing that I noticed on some of those bones is that the ends of the limb bones were often sort of chewed and sucked on. They had this really interesting frayed appearance. And so there are things that are kind of unique about the bone chewing patterns left by chimpanzees and other primates on those small prey. But two things we see at the beginning of meat eating in our evolutionary history, well, I guess three. One are those butchery marks. The other is we see meat from large animals being eaten, and we can tell that by those butchery marks.
In reading some of your papers, and there was carrying the meat away to a communal site or a shared site. That's what I found kind of interesting to the scavenging point, because when I filmed, for example, in the Serengeti, you watch, you know, lions will take down, let's say it's a wildebeest. And once the lions move off, the hyenas, then there's a hierarchy there where some hyenas will sit, others will come in and grab and then run with a piece of it off. And certainly little things like jackals will do that. They will grab a piece of meat and they will run off. I was thinking very much about these early humans who would grab the meat and let's get out of here.
And get out. And I think they needed tools to do that, you know, and especially to get meat from big animals. And I've done, part of my dissertation research was actually watching carnivores eat things. So very similar experiences, and noticing particularly that lions, that big cats, they don't tend to pull parts away from a carcass. They all feed there together. Hyenas, because of their social, you know, hierarchy and interactions, a lot of them will run in there, grab a piece with their mouth and run off. Jackals will go in there because they're so much smaller than the other predators and kind of slink around and see if they can get a little nibble. So I think that during the earliest parts of human evolution, our ancestors were very much those scavengers who either waited until the other predators were totally finished, the coast was clear, everything was safe, go in and get what was left over. And with a stone tool, not only a sharp stone tool to be able to cut meat off, but also just a, you know, basic rock to be able to bash open bones to get at the marrow inside. That's a resource that really only spotted hyenas today, with their jaws and teeth adapted to breaking open bones, for big animals are able to get at. So that might have been an interesting niche, that kind of marrow eating, bone breaking, scavenging early human.
Do we see that That particular, the bone breaking thing, do we see that in any other, in chimpanzee groups, for example?
Not that I know of. I can't think of anything I've read about chimpanzees breaking open bones. I think part of that, though, is the prey they eat when they do eat meat is usually monkeys that are so much smaller than themselves that they don't need to do that. So they can chew on bones and sort of suck out the marrow from the ends, but they don't break the bones open because they can access that marrow just with their teeth.
I'm thinking of them scavenging and the competition side of it there. And I want to back up to that evolutionary line. One of the things that I think is it's important to talk about is that there wasn't just a single creature around there that was a homo. There wasn't a single creature that was a pre-homo. I mean, there were, and I think that's a misconception people have about evolution is they think that there's like one and then the next one. And then I like your analogy of it being a bush rather than, a chain of events or a lineage there. It's like, there were a lot of different competitors of our own kind.
There were competitors of our own kind, of our own species. There were competitors of other species. There were a few different genera around on the landscape at the same time. In fact, it's actually a very weird time in human evolution because there's only one type of human on the planet. For most of our evolutionary history, there have been multiple lineages, multiple different species of hominins or early humans that coexisted at the same time. So that's something to, I don't know, maybe give us pause.
Do we know enough at this point to sort of start building a landscape of early human and pre-human? I'm trying to picture this world mm-hmm. where there was like somebody over there that kind of looked like me, mm-hmm. but wasn't me. And I went, friend or foe.
Well, and it's interesting, we can do that in a couple different ways. We can look at the hard parts, we can look at the fossils and get a little bit of a sense using kind of forensic techniques about what these different species would have looked like. Most of them would have, you would have given them a second glance on the subway or the metro. They would have looked a little different than we do today or maybe from each other. But if we think about primates that coexist around today, that may be closely related. It's questions about do they recognize each other? Are they close enough related that they might, see each other as something similar? And we know also from genetic evidence that modern humans, that our species, a few hundred thousand years ago when our species first evolved, later on, we coexisted with another species, Neanderthals, which are our close extinct relatives. And we interbred with them. We know that from genetic evidence. There's also a group called Denisovans, another ancient lineage. We interbred with them, and so did Neanderthals. And certainly, they're all probably members of this genus Homo, and close enough related, looked a little bit different, but not different enough that it kept us away from each other. So
at the time you're looking, 3 million years ago, about how many of us would there have been, or of us in the bigger sense of the word?
Yeah. So of us of different species. So, at that time there would have been one or two members of the genus Homo, maybe three. So Homo habilis, Homo rudolfensis, and Homo erectus were around by certainly a little younger than 2 million years ago. In East Africa, there was another genus Paranthropus. So there would have been Paranthropus boisei and Paranthropus Ethiopicus. In South Africa, there was sort of a similar species, Paranthropus robustus. Multiple different species and even genera at that time. So yeah, it would have been a handful of hominins at that point.
That would have been, that would have been really interesting to see. Mm-hmm. maybe time machine. We need more time machines besides just bones, I guess. When you look at a set of bones, where do you start to look? Mm-hmm. Where is even you look at this landscape and go, oh, I'll dig over there or I'll dig over there. I mean, that's, right. It's huge.
Yeah.
Right.
So the where do we dig question is a great one.
We're going to take a quick break in our wanderings around the Paleolithic and check in with assistant producer Damel Zaban. And then we'll rejoin Brianna to talk about where on this amazing planet does one begin to look for fossil clues to understanding how our ancient relatives evolved to become the curious apes we are today. Hi, Demelza.
Hello. Hope everyone's doing fabulously and enjoying this fascinating episode diving into our prehistoric past. Our last episode was a World Gorilla Day special with Dr. Katie Fawcett from GRACE, the world's only centre protecting the colossal Growers gorillas. To celebrate its release, we asked our listeners, what do you love about gorillas? So clearly, you're all absolutely gorilla mad because we had so many responses, I barely know where to start, so I'll just pick a couple. Vicky Smith said, I love that intelligent look in their eyes. Red Tyler said, have you seen them? So big and so strong. My favourite was from Marie Claire Crossley, who said, I love everything about gorillas. Their look, their intelligence, their integrity, their sense of family, the pure love they show each other. If the gorillas become extinct, humans have no right to survive either. I just love them. Greer Bullock also wrote in. She said it was really interesting to learn about the Growers and the work of GRACE. And what a way to celebrate World Gorilla Day. Thank you, Greer. Don't forget, you can support us by becoming a Patreon troop member or purchasing some of our gorgeous Talking Apes merchandise. We've got a lovely line of t-shirts, hoodies and sweaters, and I promise you're all going to look absolutely stunning in them. We work so hard to expand global awareness on the issues facing apes and their habitats, and we can't continue the work we do without support. So head over to talkingapes.org to learn more. Before I go, I'd like to give a shout out to our phenomenal volunteers, Zoe and Theo. They've been working hard on expanding our social media outreach onto new platforms. More about that in the next episode. Please make sure you follow us on our other social accounts. All the links are on our website. And please, 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 wherever you're listening to this, like, subscribe, leave us a 5-star rating or a review. Doing any of that will help us reach more people, and that way we can encourage more to care about apes and the broader natural world. That's all from me. Thank you for listening. And now back to the wonderful Brianna and Jerry.
Thanks, Demelza. And now back to my conversation with Dr. Brianna Pobiner.
So I've been involved with excavations at various different, you know, paleoanthropological sites, Kubi Fura in Kenya, Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania, Olorgesailie Saile also in Kenya, and other places. And there's a couple things you look for. One is I will always say, you know, we use maps, but different kinds of maps. So we use our usual geographic maps, but we also use geological maps, which are basically maps of time. So if you have questions based in particular time intervals, you want to target the dirt or the sediments in that time. If I want to know what people were eating 1.5 million years ago, I will look for a place where those 1.5 million-year-old sediments are exposed. You want to go to a place where there's a lot of erosion, so nature can do the first excavations for you. Oftentimes, as paleoanthropologists, we go to places where other people have excavated before and found something. Oh. You might find site reports. You might go, oh, yeah, in 1936, so-and-so went here and, you know, found fossils and deposited them in this museum. And now we're going to see if we can go back and find that site again. So it's the right time, the right kinds of sediments, and to a place that is pretty... you know, not a lot of vegetation is good because it's really hard to find fossils on the surface. If you're walking around, you know, barren landscapes are great, really lush vegetation, not so good for finding fossils. And then the other thing you want to look for is not necessarily where fossils have eroded out and maybe collected in one area on the ground. What you really want to look for is where is the layer that those fossils are coming from? Because when the fossils and artifacts are what's called in situ, in place, then you're much more likely to be able to figure out how old they are, and how old they are is a really big part of the story that they tell.
So that brings me to a really great word, taphonomy. That is awesome. Awesome word. Yes. Maybe you can explain it because it sounds like it has to do a little bit with this.
Yeah. So taphonomy is basically, it's the study of the life history of fossils. It's the study of how a bone went from being in a living animal to showing up on a museum shelf. So an animal is living, it's died, it's on the landscape, it gets buried, it gets fossilized, it gets dug up, and it gets studied. And so that whole process is the taphonomic process of the basically, you know, it's literally, it means the study of the laws of burial, but it's kind of everything that happens to a bone in between life and like preservation and fossilization. And even afterwards, because sometimes things happen after bones get fossilized.
So you're looking at a very specific part in the sort of layering of that history, aren't you? Especially if you're looking at scrapings on bones and marks.
Exactly. So I'm really interested in what happened after an animal died, but before the animal became part of the fossil record. So when it was still fresh, when there was still resources, meat, marrow, other things. When it was still food is basically the part that I'm interested in. Exactly.
Well, you mentioned deposits in museums and, 1930 or whatever, you look at something. Where are we in terms of what you do with technology? Because it just, the reason that kind of came to my mind the other day when I was reading some of the stuff that you had published was I was thinking about LIDAR. Mm-hmm. And now how we look at forests, you know, we used to be able to just basically fly over in an airplane, take a picture, and you could kind of look down at the trees and a botanist could maybe make out what a couple of the trees were, get a sense of it. Otherwise, you had to do a transect on the ground and walk through and do that whole thing. Now with LIDAR, we can actually look down from the canopy, down into the layers, all the way down to the bottom, and we can actually tell what those plants are. We could build that out. And that I'm wondering, is there an archaeological kind of version of LIDAR? I mean, can we start looking into that place that you want to excavate?
So the tough thing about that is if you're looking for structures like buildings, yes, potentially, you might be able to, you know, see that kind of thing with ground penetrating radar, with GPR. It's a little tougher when you're looking at fossils and artifacts because essentially they are all rocks. And so be able to really tell the difference between what's a natural rock and what's a, you know, human modified rock or what is a fossil that was once a bone that has essentially become a rock through the process of fossilization. Where we might be able to do that is if there are very specific layers where you have a lot of fossils or artifacts, we may be able to see that. Where technology comes in a little bit more, though, with the butchery marks that I study, is that there are now folks, some of whom I collaborate with because I appreciate this level of technology. My technology is, you know, I take a magnifying lens and I look through it. That's my high technology to be able to look for marks on bones. But I have collaborators that are able to use more sophisticated technology to really capture high resolution, three-dimensional shape data of those small marks on bones. That lets us get a lot better at being able to identify what made that mark. Was it a carnivore tooth? Was it a stone tool? Was it, you know, a porcupine tooth? Was it a crocodile tooth? Was it just from that bone rolling around in a river and scraping against sediment? These are all different processes, and some of them make marks that look really similar. But the better we get at capturing that 3D data and having good comparative collections where we know what made those marks, then we're going to get better at identifying the marks on the fossil bones.
Can we now use AI to do some of that?
Yeah, I was going to say there, you know, if you look at the publication record of this sort of thing in the last 5 or 10 years, there are definitely some interesting papers on machine learning and AI and being able to sort of teach a system how to do those identifications. There's still, in my view, an important role for people and humans in that process, in the sense of figuring out where is the mark on the bone. You know, is that a place where a muscle attached? Is it a place that makes sense to have a butchery mark? Are there other marks around it that look similar? Are they all facing in the same direction? which might tell you their butchery marks. Are they facing in all different directions? That might tell you that they're abrasion marks. So I think a combination potentially of using maybe it's AI or machine learning, but also, still having a role for, in some sense, that kind of expert eye.
Yeah. So going back to the museums, how much are we now digging into old museum? I mean, that seems like it becomes almost, a specialty of its own, is to uncover what we didn't know in these museums. If we can now have these technologies to look 3D at bones.
Well, I'm glad you asked about that, because I'm actually doing more and more of that in my research these days. So, uncovering, or like you said, digging into museum collections. I have several projects going on right now where I'm looking back in collections that were excavated decades ago, where people didn't think these butchery marks would be there because they didn't think that, people were there that long ago, or they didn't know how to recognize those marks, or they didn't think they would be in this area at this time. So going back to those collections and looking with kind of new eyes, with new technology, I think is actually really important.
Does that then inspire new field work in those areas?
It certainly could, and I think it should. Absolutely.
Yeah, because I would think if you found something that you didn't know existed, 50 years ago or something on some bones, you go back in that area, that same area, and say, wait a second, let's take another fresh look at this whole
site. Exactly. Dig up some more, see what we can find.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Describe in a little more detail, if you could, the difference between, for example, a tooth mark and these marks. If we can get some samples, permission from you and get some samples, we do a blog that accompanies this, and we'll put some of those things up on there so people can actually see
perfect
what they look like. But maybe you could describe those a little bit.
Yeah. And so while there are some marks that are ambiguous and overlap, there are some general differences between cut marks or butchery marks. There's two kinds of butchery marks. There's cut marks and percussion marks. Percussion marks are the ones that happen when you use a stone to break open a bone to get at the marrow inside. But the cut marks are the ones that can look, and percussion marks can look very similar to tooth marks. But cut marks, because they're made with the edge of a sharp edge tool, they tend to have a V shape on the bottom from that sharp edge. They tend to be very straight and linear. They tend to be oftentimes a little bit shorter sometimes than tooth marks. And they tend to be, if they're in a patch, they're usually oriented in the same direction where someone sort of, slicing down a bone. They're oftentimes at a place where muscles attach or where joints are together if you're trying to cut those apart. Tooth marks can have either rounded shapes, a little more similar to percussion marks, but the longer, thinner ones, the tooth scores, they will often have a U or a rounded shape on the bottom instead of a sharp one, because of the shapes of different carnivore teeth. They will sometimes be a little bit wavier, not as straight. And they will be, sometimes they'll be in places where muscles attach, but they'll often be just kind of, like little nibbling all over the bone. Sometimes you can have an isolated mark. Sometimes you have patches of marks. But it's the shape, it's the orientation, and it's the location on the bone that can separate those two kinds of marks.
Do you ever look at trying to figure out how to pose this question? I'm thinking of you sitting there and you're in a pile of dirt down in a hole somewhere in East Africa. Is there something that you go, oh, that almost tripped me up, or like, damn, that did trip me up, I didn't guess that was that? Or what is there something about what you do that is constantly kind of got you guessing on the edge?
Well, I mean, I have to say, I don't know all the time. And so I think every good scientist should do that and probably more often than we do. I have had many experiences excavating where I'm starting to uncover something and I'm going, oh, I think this might be that. I mean, I was in an excavation once and we thought we had the youngest saber-toothed cat fossil ever found, got really excited, this long, shiny tooth, and it turned out to be a warthog tusk, a type, basically a pig relative. So nope, not a saber tooth. And sometimes even, doing excavations in places where there are assemblages of butchery marks, sometimes I will also be uncovering a fossil and go, oh, I think that's a butchery. No, it looks like it's probably more those sedimentary abrasion marks. So the other thing is that I spend quite a bit of time trying to figure out what bone is this and what animal is it from, in addition to actually looking at the surfaces to see if there are marks on it. So I sometimes joke I have to go to the bone library and like check out a bone instead of pulling a book off the shelf. So I do most of this work in Kenya, at the National Museums of Kenya in the paleontology division, is like this beautiful bone and fossil library where I'm able to either look in the fossil comparative collection or sometimes the modern comparative collection in the osteology division. I can take a little piece of broken bone down and just see what it best matches up to. That part is really fun. It's kind of like detective work. And every once in a while, oh, there's one that just sticks in your head. Or you pull something out of the ground and you go, I know I've seen this before. What is this from? What is this from? And so it can be a combination of looking at those comparative collections, looking even in, you know, books that have illustrations of bones, and just, you know, doing the best job you can of trying to figure out what that bone is.
I ran across actualism, mm-hmm. the word, and looking at ancient molecules and think, how much does that play now, talking about technology and our ability to look at things through a different lens, so to speak?
Yeah. So actualism is like studying the present to understand the past. And so it's doing, you know, experimental archaeology is one facet of actualism, and it's looking at a process in the present, and that process creates a product. So when I, you know, thinking about butchery, you do a butchery experiment, you replicate stone tools, you cut meat off of a bone, and you look at that cut mark. That's a process. That butchery process creates a product. You can look at the product on the fossil, look at something that looks like a butchery mark, and infer the process. So it's really, it's studying the present to understand the past. And it plays a huge role in the type of work that I do. In trying to understand these, especially when we look at kind of assemblage level patterns of the locations of marks, the shapes of marks, what kind of stone raw material was used. We do experimental archaeology and butchery experiments all the time in order to be able to answer these questions in a more refined way. It's really important.
Once the bone becomes fossilized to that point, is there chemically anything that we can pull from that?
Once a bone becomes a fossil, you can look at, there's a couple different sort of types of isotopes that you can look at to either figure out what that animal was eating. So one is the C3 and C4, two different pathways that plants use to photosynthesize. Those kind of leave different chemical impressions in a sense, or chemical, the word I want to use. They leave different chemical signatures in the fossils, and we can actually look at that to figure out whether those animals were eating mostly C3 plants, so leafy plants like trees, bushes, or mostly C4 plants, grasses. That's a pretty broad division, but that's usually how it goes. So we can do that. The other isotope system, one of them is nitrogen isotopes. So as you go up the food chain, your bones will become more enriched with nitrogen isotopes. And so you can actually kind of get a sense of how, you know, whether the bone you're looking at is from an animal that was a top predator versus kind of an herbivore or a primary producer. So in kind of broad swaths, we can use that sort of chemistry, and you can actually do that. A lot of those analyses on fossil bones.
I mean, I understand that there's often very little evidence when you're finding things there. It's probably pretty rare when you hit this little gold mine of stuff that's just like bones and marks and things everywhere. Have you ever found bones where beings using the same tool over and over and over again? Like we see that with chimpanzees now, we're starting to see more and more of them. You know, when Jane witnessed the tool use, and Leakey said, you know, it's the whole famous saying about we have to redefine tool or redefine human.
That's
at that
right.
point. The next step in that was this thing, anticipatory tool use, which it gets a lot less notice, I think, by people. But to me, it's the most fascinating because it's a shift in the brain. It's not just using it. It's like, I need this in the future. Mm-hmm. And that there is a future. I don't just make the hammer and throw it away. I may want that. So I save the hammer. And we see that with chimps, like protecting and guarding a stone that really fits. And I'm wondering about that in terms of these marks, like if there's a way to see that, yeah, well, I made this tool and I kept this tool and I made it, I cut different bones and I cut, that probably is tough, but.
It is tough. That's a good question. I'm trying to think, you know, how would I go about figuring that out? I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know how you could do that. You might be able to see if your cut marks had, you know, some sort of unusual shape and that you saw that shape in the cut mark over and over again. I don't know. That's a tough one. That's a tough one, I think, to be able to see with butchery marks specifically. One thing you might be able to do is to actually look at the edge of the tools themselves, the edge of the stone tools, and you can sometimes tell if those tools have been resharpened or reshaped. And if they've been used repeatedly, you might see that evidence of resharpening or kind of reshaping to get another sharp edge.
Do you often find that the bones and the tools side by side or with close proximity to one another?
Interestingly, sometimes yes and sometimes no. I would say, and I was just looking at this in publishing a book chapter with several co-authors on the zooarchaeological record, so the animal fossil record associated with archaeological sites from the entirety of Africa. It was a heck of a data set to put together. And we looked at, you know, whether there were stone tools and hominin fossils found with these big collections of animal fossils. And most of the time you do find them together. Sometimes you just find the tools themselves. And occasionally, and sometimes you just find the fossils themselves. The trick about that is that unless those fossils have butchery marks, you don't know if humans had something to do with them or if that was just a natural fossil accumulation. And sometimes you just find butchery marked fossils by themselves. That's a little less common. That's much less common, actually. But I think early on, there was the assumption that anytime you found tools associated with fossil animals, oh, well, humans brought the animals there, but not necessarily.
I guess if you're packing away the meat, you don't necessarily always need to take the bone with you.
Well, certainly, you know, cutting the meat off so that you can leave the bone behind unless you're going to eat that marrow. The other thing is maybe, you know, eating meat from the bones and then discarding the bones elsewhere. It's another good way to avoid having the saber tooth sniffing around or hyenas or anything else. So you may, if you have your tools in one place, and, you know, there are ideas about sort of caching your stone tools. You want to put the tools somewhere where you can remember to go back to them. You know, you probably don't want to have your, you know, discarded meat or bone bits in the same place if it's a place you want to hang around because you don't want other predators coming after you.
Yeah. How do we find a place that we might want to take meat off to, or how do you go about figuring out how often that place was used? Based on these bones, like they've carried them back 18 times to the same place.
Yeah,
is there a way to do that?
Great question. So the method you would probably use that I would start with is ethnoarchaeology. So basically looking at modern peoples who, you know, hunt animals and take them back to places. And what do their accumulations look like. I worked with a graduate student at George Washington University last year who did her master's project re-looking at some ethnoarchaeological bone assemblages from a couple of decades ago from folks in Botswana. And, you know, how big are those accumulations you might be able to look at? It's the tough part is that, you know, we using today's modern humans and assuming that behavior hasn't changed for a million years is a little bit of a difficult assumption. in many ways, you can't always, it's not always a very easy ratio of if we have, you know, this many people, you're going to have this volume of tools or bones in your assemblage. And unfortunately, you know, people who are interested in trying to figure out population levels in the past, can we do it like on number of archaeological sites, number of tools you find in your sites? It's, I don't think there's that close of a relationship or a connection.
Before we leave this, is there anything we can do looking at other apes, especially, I guess, chimpanzees in particular? Is there anything we can look at them now, and especially with all of the, it seems like more and more sort of cultural discoveries and behavioral discoveries are coming out. Is it that helps you in your work and thinking, or it shifts your thinking about how you approach your work?
I mean, I think in many ways, I want to say everything from the sense of, you know, anything, you know, if my work interested in diets in particular, but, you know, meat eating, especially, you know, what kinds of circumstances do we see that taking place in, you know, with chimps, with other primates? What are the social contexts? What is the ecological context? You know, what is the, what are the different, you know, kind of dynamics around? So all of that, I think, can inform those of us who are trying to understand our deeper prehistory using chimps as models, just as in many ways, with caution, that we would use, you know, modern humans doing those behaviors as models today. So no, I think it's all informative.
What brought that to mind was thinking about the Fingoli chimps that Jill Pruitt has studied, and this idea of invisible items.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, sometimes it's so frustrating going, oh, well, this could have happened, but this would have been archaeologically invisible. You know, if early humans were using sharpened sticks like the Fingoli chimps do to, you know, spear bush babies, if they were throwing rocks and using those as weapons or for defense, you know, there are certain criteria by which your material culture will become visible in the archaeological record. And when that doesn't happen, you know, we have to, I don't know, get more creative. But yeah, sometimes there are unanswerable questions, unfortunately.
Yeah, I was thinking about, we had someone on in season two, Jilly Forrester from the UK, and she's doing cognitive work, especially on early development in children, infants to about 5 years old. And now she's turned a lot of her study to looking at other great apes and their development. And she talks about the fact that it's these invisible parts of the that you're trying to do. So you have to extrapolate it from other things, like looking at how a tool was built and then try to extrapolate from how the brain was working at that point. And that's kind of where I was going with it. Mm-hmm. Because the next question I had to you was to go back to your meat eating and the use of fire. That bridge right there, because that's a shift in the way our brains were approaching food.
Absolutely. I mean, if I will often say there were three big shifts in our diets in prehistory. The first was including meat from big animals that you needed tools to get into. That was a big shift. The second one, I think, is cooking and fire. The third one is agriculture and domestication. And, you know, that impacted not only humans, but the rest of the planet forevermore. But yeah, I think that cooking, the use of fire for various things, but particularly to transform our food, was a huge shift. Is something really that I know of that only humans do to our food.
Was there a shift in tools and the way that we approached the meat when we started cooking?
So to answer that question, we would have to know when we started cooking. And I think that's still up for debate in many ways. Depending on who you ask, you'll get different answers of how far back do we see cooking in prehistory. I think the best solid evidence goes back about 1 million years. There are certainly hints of it a little bit older than that at a couple different places. And it's really not until less than 500,000 years ago that you start to see more systematic use of fire for cooking. So one of the questions, and I think in many ways where sometimes, you know, paleoanthropologists get into some pretty serious debates, is the first instance of seeing a new behavior the this important shift, or is it when it becomes more regular and more part of our behavioral repertoire? I think the answer is yes to both of those. I think both of those are important. But to get back to your question about tools, we see a big shift in stone tool technology with the advent of Acheulean tools. It's kind of the first big innovation. The earliest tools, well, the earliest tool is a industry from one site called the Lamequian, from the site of Lamequi. But the Olduwan is really the earliest, more widely spread, recognized stone tool technology. Started about 2.9, I think now, actually. And then at 1.7 million years ago, you get the first big shift. You get the making of the Acheulean technology. And that's bifacial technology, flaking both sides of your core. And the most common or the iconic tool from the Acheulean are hand axes, teardrop-shaped tools. Those are basically just a great way to knock off a lot of flakes from the same core. So they're sort of flake dispensers. And there's lots of questions of what were Acheulean hand axes used for? Probably a lot of things. And so we see that shifted 1.7 million years ago. Don't know if that's coincident with the earliest evidence for fire. Doesn't seem to be really coincident, but if you're looking at, I don't know, a million, a little less than a million years ago, we don't actually really see a big shift in technology at that point. But if we're looking maybe when technology, maybe when fire became a lot more common and consistent 500, 400,000 years ago, I don't, there's sort of gradual, more sophisticated tools being made, smaller tools, tools made for very specific purposes. But that's a very long-winded answer to, I don't actually think there's right now that I know of, there's a good link between starting to use fire and a change in stone tool technology.
Is it, do you think it's a case of just, there's just too many gaps in the record?
I think the gaps make a big difference. It's hard to connect the lines in some ways with those gaps, but I think maybe just not having, I think the evidence for fire is there's a pretty high bar for that to find really incontrovertible evidence for hearths and burning. And so I, you know, it may be that that evidence actually goes back quite a bit further.
How do we tie a species to the tools?
We can't. Is my sad or disappointing answer.
That's not the answer I wanted.
It's, I know, me neither, no. Believe me. Until we find tools in the fossil hands of the skeletons of particular species. Yeah, it's really, I think traditionally we have made sort of implicit connections between, oh, members of the genus Homo are the ones that made tools. But there have been several discoveries in the last couple of years that are really forcing us to rethink that. I will say a little bit later in prehistory, it does seem like, for instance, Neanderthals are associated with specific types of stone tools. Early modern humans are associated with other types of stone tools. But I think sort of earlier on in some of the time periods we've been talking about, I think we just can't. Until you get to a point at which you only have one species in a place, one human, early human species in a place at a time, and then you know that that species made those tools. But when you have multiple species around at the same time, I don't think we can say with any confidence. Disappointing, I know.
Well, yeah, because there's so many other questions that peel off of that.
I mean, you think, I know.
You got one species that's making a tool and another species come along and look at it and go, and pick up that tool.
Exactly. That could have happened. It could have been, you know, another species could have come along and sort of watched and imitated. They could, yeah, there's all kinds of scenarios. We need time machines.
Yeah. I thought that's what you were all about, is time machines and figuring out the bones. And
that's
where they,
my next grant, definitely.
Your next. Yeah, exactly. For just a minute, talk about fire and cooking. What did that do in terms of the species that we were and became?
Yeah.
Is it so critical?
Yeah, I think cooking is critical because it really drastically widens the different kinds of foods that we can eat that foods become palatable that weren't, foods become safe that weren't. It's a way of physically and chemically breaking down food before we even ingest it. So it really transforms, I think, our kind of the menu from which we can choose the different kind, you know, different kinds of food. So
physically, what did that do to us?
Yeah, again, it's hard to, without, you know, without having a good firm answer to when did that start and when did it become more common question, it's hard to know, because we can look at physical changes over human evolutionary history. And people have gone, oh, well, maybe fire was related to a relative increase in brain size. So humans have enormous brains, modern humans. They're very energetically expensive. Not such a good strategy for, you know, needing to consume all this high quality food. There's an idea that maybe it was cooking that basically kind of released a constraint and allowed that brain size to increase so much. There must have been selective pressure to do that, probably from social interactions, is my guess. So, you know, maybe it had to do with this increase in brain size. Maybe it had to do with a big difference in pre-Homo erectus body size and shape, and then Homo erectus and later is kind of a shrinking of the gut area and going from a more chimp-like gut to a sort of narrower, taller bodies. And so maybe that had to do with cooking and getting, you know, whether it was plants or meat that was cooked, that, you know, we could eat more high quality food that was cooked. So
that's driving a question about chimps that eat more meat than other chimps. And if we're what we see over time,
yeah, it would be interesting to actually look if there are significant differences in chimp groups as far as how much meat they eat. You'd need, I don't know, a couple hundred years, I think, though, to be able to do that kind of study. So,
well, I mean, that's the one thing, talking to, you know, Kat Hobater, for example, and talking about her work. One of the things that was interesting was the fact that we're just now getting to the point where we're seeing multiple generations of chimps. We've studied groups long enough that, you know, like at Kibali and other places, that we've studied them long enough that we're just starting to see some of those behavioral things that are being passed on. So I guess we need a lot more years to be able to see some physiological things that are being moved. Speaking of diets, Paleolithic diet. What the heck is that about? Both in terms of the media and the, you know, that, but what it really was.
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm starting to write a book about it, actually. That's my next big project. So, you know, come back in a couple of years and I'll be able to tell you succinctly. But, you know, modern paleo diet movements, the idea that if we ate the way that our ancestors ate, we might live long, healthy, disease-free lives, because our ancestors were well adapted for all the different foods that they ate. I think, like, most of those assumptions are false. And a lot, you know, the modern paleo diet movements are very much about excluding whole food groups from your diet. I like to joke a lot of the time, I can't imagine a hominin out there going, oh, can't eat that. Not on my paleo diet. I don't think that's how it worked. You know, I think the paleo diet was eat anything you can. That's what I think the real paleo diet was. You know, it was bugs. It was, you know, scraps of meat left over from predator kills. It was plants, you know, fruits in season. It was really anything you could get your hands on. So,
and we see that. That's interesting because we see that in the other great apes. I mean, orangutans, over 400 types including some meat, but over 400 types of, you know, plants and seeds and fruits and so forth, and chimps easily a couple of hundred. They you know, that tastes good, I'll give it a try.
Right. It's not going to kill me. Excellent. You know, maybe learn that the hard way. Yeah. These ideas that, like, our, you know, ancient humans were like huge meat eaters. Not the case. Even, you know, coming from someone who studies meat eating, that's not how it worked. And the idea that we haven't had enough time to evolve, to adapt to different kinds of foods, dairy and other things and grains, I don't buy that either. So, but stay tuned. I'll tell you more about that another time.
Great. Well, we've talked on a couple of occasions about a time machine. If you could invent a time machine that could take you back, is there one particular moment and one particular thing that you just like, damn, if I just knew that and could watch that happen, is there a particular homo that you would love to observe doing a particular thing that would somehow really shift the way you look at all of this?
You know, that's a great question. And I'm particularly interested. I'm reading a book now by Sergio Almeida, which is an edited volume where he asked a bunch of human evolution specialists a bunch of questions, including that one. If you had a time machine, what moment would you go back and look at? So if you're interested, delightful book. And I would, because I'm interested in meat eating, particularly during the time of Homo erectus, I would love to go see an interaction between Homo erectus and other predators and all the things that we can't actually get from the fossils. How many individuals were there? What kind of season was it? What was the environment like? What was their behavior like? Are they like, what was that actual interaction like? So I would love to be able to like spend a day watching Homo erectus scavenge from predators.
I would love to see how many of them were together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's always something that's fascinated me in filming and watching great apes other than humans is, well, even humans, but they don't usually let me film them as much, but is the number of individuals and how the individuals change the operation or interaction. And
yeah.
That's what, you know, whenever
I would love to watch them interact. Like, yeah. I love you. How do they communicate with each other? I would love to be able to see that.
Because you see these dioramas in museums, and I'm sure there's some in your museum. It always shows maybe two or three doing a thing. Like, why aren't there 35 of them standing
right
there around doing it? Little ones running around and playing, and then older ones scolding them. And I mean, because that's what you see in a group of chimps.
Yeah. Yep.
You see all of that chaos and all of that drama, mm-hmm. and, you know, some of them sleeping over in a corner and, you know, whatever, you know, it's just,
yeah,
that's the part that I guess we will never really fully know.
No.
Because it's that kind of invisible part of it. Brianna, this was really a lot of fun.
Thank you. I enjoyed it too.
Can we do this again?
I would love to.
And like I said before we jumped on, hopefully I can come to the museum and we can do something there and a podcast live from there or something.
That'd be so fun.
That would be really, really great. Keep in touch. Anything
I will do.
You're writing, publishing, send this way. And let's catch up again.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks for being on Talking Apes. This is really wonderful.
Thank you.
I want to thank Brianna for that wonderful journey into our past. You'll find a blog with fascinating photos of bones and stone tools that we talked about on our website at talkingapes.org. That's talkingapes, one word, .org. You've been listening to Talking Apes, the podcast that gets to the heart of what's happening with and to apes like us. Our conversations are with folks from across this planet of apes, writers, researchers, conservationists, and scientists, all getting us closer to understanding who we are and why. Because ensuring the survival of the other four great apes is the only way to ensure our own. I would like to thank our entire Talking Apes team for all the work they do in bringing this podcast to you. And I would like to thank you, the donors and Patreon members who make Talking Apes successful through your generous support and the sharing of this podcast. If you appreciate what you hear on Talking Apes, consider supporting us by visiting our website at talkingapes.org. Finally, I would like to thank the dedicated folks on the front line of great ape survival. We hope through Talking Apes we're able to shine a light on the incredible selfless work you do every day to ensure great apes, primates, and their forest homes survive and thrive deep into the future. I'm Jerry Ellis. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing with family and friends the Talking Apes podcast.